You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Steve Hubble with the Open Society Fellowship Program. Sarah Spencer is one of our current Open Society Fellows. I'm going to turn over the mic to my colleague Archana Sagal, who is Program Officer with the Equality Fund of U.S. programs here at OSF. Archana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Steve. Hello, everyone. Welcome. Thanks for joining us on this kind of cloudy Wednesday afternoon. I'm very excited to be able to have facilitate this conversation about why cities provide services to undocumented migrants. We've got two incredibly esteemed speakers. To my left, we have Sarah Spencer, esteemed Open Society Fellow and the former chair of the Equality and Diversity Forum. Sarah is also served on a number of organizations' boards and as staff as the deputy chair of the Commission for Racial Equality. And in 2007, she won a major award in recognition for her work on human rights and equal opportunities. And to my right is the very esteemed Fatima Shama. Fatima is the commissioner for immigrant affairs for the city of New York. And you cannot go anywhere in New York City, or for that matter, because she's taken her show on the road, without knowing anyone that has not come into the amazingness known as Fatima Shama, given the fact that really connecting the work of immigration, immigrant rights with state and localities around the country. So it's a real pleasure to have this conversation here today. We're hoping that Sarah will be able to start and have a conversation for the next 8 to 10 minutes. And in response, Fatima will be able to respond, and then we'll be able to ask a few questions. And I'm hoping that this is a real conversation. Many of you in the room have deep experience in working with immigrants, deep experience working for city governments, and so hoping that this is not a typical panel discussion, but this is a real opportunity to get into real lessons learned, to have a conversation about what we're experiencing and what's possible across the way. So thank you. And with that, Sarah. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you. It's fantastic to be here. Having an Open Society Fellowship has been the most wonderful opportunity and incredible luxury to explore an issue in depth and indulge my interest in it, and hopefully create something useful and help shift agendas, which was the purpose of it. And of course, I've been looking at the European experience of government and city responses to undocumented migrants. The last time I met Fatima, we were in Turin, in Italy, at a transatlantic dialogue between cities on integration. And integration in Europe means legal migrants. But Fatima was bold enough to ask the cities, yes, but what about the undocumented migrants? None of you have mentioned those. And the reaction from them was very telling. They froze. There was one particular German representative who said, I can't answer that question. That's a matter for the national government. Essentially, we don't talk about this in public. I think the American cities were somewhat bemused by this, because your experience is so different. But it was very telling for me, their reaction, and realizing that this was something that the cities didn't talk about openly. And in fact, when I organized a session at the Conference of Eurocities, that's the network of the largest European cities, the largest 130, in Tampere in Finland in September, it was the first time they had ever discussed this issue. And yet cities across Europe, of course, do provide services to irregular or undocumented migrants, from education to healthcare, from child protection to emergency welfare payments to shelter to language classes. They do provide services, but they do so quietly. And in Europe, European migration scholars, they draw a distinction between what they call the sunshine politics of talking about immigration control. That's where you talk about it very loudly, you want a big fanfare because the public love it. And they talk about the shadow politics of immigrant rights. That's what you talk about very quietly. This has a low visibility. You're trying to avoid any controversy, any political risk to the politicians involved. You'd much rather adjust the rules behind the scenes than have to take it to the full meeting of the Assembly or the Parliament to discuss it publicly. And that's exactly what I've found when I've been going around talking to cities and national governments across Europe about what services people are entitled to and why. And with some few exceptions, like Utrecht, for instance, in the Netherlands, which was able to have a full debate amongst all its aldermen and get agreement on provision of services after a young undocumented woman was raped in the city, and the shock that this could happen, a homeless young woman in the city, was so great that it sort of galvanized them into a political agreement. But it's much more common to have, for instance, in Barcelona, they do talk about it, the officials and the politicians together, but they don't actually write it down. So it's not there in documentary form. Or indeed in Athens, where they have a food bank for migrants and they give the leftovers to irregular migrants. I have to say, they always make sure there are a lot of leftovers to make sure that they can get them, but they can't acknowledge that this is what they're doing, so it's sort of done behind the scenes. And then there are German and Finnish and other cities which actually do it through NGOs, not-for-profit organisations. They give them money to provide services to migrants, and they just make sure there are no questions asked about what their immigration status is. Now, what that means, of course, is that the whole thing is a sort of grey area. It's sort of ambiguous and uncertain and very vulnerable at a time of recession to being pulled back. So, for instance, in Athens, they always allowed the children to go to preschool, not just to compulsory education, but actually wanted them to be in the nurseries. They just didn't ask what their immigration status was. I understand that's now much more difficult. They have to ask, and that means these kids won't get to go to school. It creates great uncertainty for migrants, whether they're entitled or not, very difficult for the NGOs, and interestingly also very difficult for the city staff. In the briefing that you have that I did for this conference a couple of weeks ago, you'll see a quote from a Danish city official who works with homeless people, who said, "It's the most difficult thing about my job, this sort of being acknowledged and not being acknowledged, accepted and not accepted." So I think the question is, why do the cities do it if it's all so difficult? And the answers they give are, well, you know, humanitarian concerns, ethical concerns, particularly where children are involved. Human rights law, sometimes that actually in European context overrides national law, so they will provide it for that reason. But also for the pragmatic reason that they simply can't achieve many of their objectives if they don't include this section of the population. So public health, crime prevention, reducing street sleeping, reducing the number of street prostitutes, all of these issues, cohesion, social cohesion, or avoiding reliance on emergency services by making sure people get them when they're less ill, for instance. All of those pragmatic reasons are part of the rationale for why they do it, and while they feel an imperative to do it despite the obstacles. And national governments, of course, feel some of the same imperatives. It's interesting that Sweden, for instance, the national government changed the law this year to provide undocumented migrants with access to healthcare. The UK government, despite our politics on this issue, decided last year to provide full access to AIDS treatment, purely on public health grounds, that they couldn't actually achieve their objectives on AIDS if they didn't include this group. But the difference, of course, is that national governments feel the overriding imperative most of the time of immigration control. And for the cities, the priorities are very different. So as the public health official in Rotterdam said to me, the national government doesn't need to bother with the problems that we have every day. And the cities regularly find themselves thwarted in their effort to provide services by national immigration restrictions that make it difficult for them to do so. So I thought I'd just close with four lessons or observations that throw into the pot for discussion that I would take from this. One of them is that in Europe it's the cities that are driving this agenda through their practices of provision of services, but actually also through succeeding in changing the law. In Italy, for instance, it was the municipalities providing access to nursery education that in the end led to the government changing the law through a test case. In the Netherlands, it was municipalities insisting on the right of the undocumented young people to do apprenticeships after they left school that again resulted in a change to the law, actually because the aldermen in Amsterdam Lam, who'd been fighting for this, then became the social affairs minister in the government, so he could hardly change his mind at that point. And German cities, German regional governments that refused to pass on the data of undocumented pupils to the national government, as they were supposed to do, and then eventually were successful in getting the national government to change the law so that data didn't have to be handed over, which meant that the kids actually could go to school. So I think if funders or NGOs were looking for non-traditional allies on this issue, then cities would have to be up there as one place to start. And another place would be doctors. It's significant how often they appear as leading advocates in the campaign to get access to healthcare. And the NGOs have been very effective in working with the doctors to get their voice heard. The second point I wanted to make is that I've found, and I keep being told this, that how the issue is framed is incredibly important in whether the campaign is successful or not. If it can be framed as a technical change, not a big political issue of principle, but actually just a shift in the rules, for instance, on whether the data of the service users has to be passed on to the police or doesn't have to be passed on, that can make all of the difference in whether the entitlement is there or it isn't. And secondly, if it can be framed as an existing practice, the cities do this anyway, the regional governments do this anyway, then the national governments think it's not such a big thing to do it, we can just say that this is what's happening already. And I think the lesson from that is it doesn't always pay to frame the issue as a big issue of principle in human rights terms. It actually might be an easier way to win the argument. The third point is that I'm finding that there is some scope at European level, at that overarching supranational level, to make progress on this. We had a superb roundtable in the Open Society Brussels office 2 weeks ago looking at European Union agendas in relation to children, and found there's actually some movement there, some possible scope for getting their agendas to embrace undocumented children within health agendas, education and poverty and so on, even if the migration agenda, policy agenda, is so difficult. And at the Council of Europe level, which you'll know is a completely separate body, the human rights body, there is part of that, the social charter, which is being, the committee that oversees that is being very proactive in taking the rights of undocumented children to be part of the rights that they protect. And they're looking for more test cases in order to take that protection further. And my final point would be, I think European cities could learn a hell of a lot from American cities. And we'll see when we've heard what Fatima has to say. It's true that you're polarised here, and there's some cities we don't want to learn from in experience. But experience of New York or Chicago or New Haven, and I know a number of other cities, your practices and policies are way ahead of what is happening in Europe. And you've any hot tips on how we can shape our debate in your direction, I'm all ears and very interested to know.
Well, all eyes are on you now.
Right. Yeah. So thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be having this conversation with you, and Marcina, for you to be sort of guiding us, if you will. We had a chance actually to meet Sarah when she started on this research, and I think it's fun to sort of come full circle. So I'm going to speak a little bit about what Sarah just shared, and then I'm going to specifically speak about New York City, because there is a very large distinction between what localities and states across the country do in this work. And we, like places like Chicago, LA, San Francisco, New Haven, are certainly on the, I think, more progressive side of things. There are many localities that are not, and some of that actually is not because of their desire, but largely because of state governments and forget national governments and what, you know, the federal government does, but state governments, which have become more divisive and really have hampered and injured our work with immigrant integration largely across the country. But more importantly, I think as I have experienced, the reality of how folks talk about serving the undocumented population, in New York, we're pretty comfortable to talk about this. I will openly say, though, that you won't find everyone who's very comfortable talking about this. But generally speaking, New York City, is pretty clear that we're here to serve any and every New Yorker. And it starts for us, the idea of framing is really important because leadership matters. But you will find that it is, in fact, oftentimes it could be as quiet about how and the kind of work that we do. And I'm going to try to give examples as I talk through this, but a most recent example for us here in New York has been around the Hurricane Sandy, mm-hmm. and its implications on immigrants, and in particular undocumented immigrants. We were able to very much recognize that we have legal status households, mixed status households, that being perhaps undocumented parents with U.S. citizen born children, which provides them benefits in some instances, but we have undocumented households. And we actually came up, I would say, for many of us internally who find ourselves to be real advocates on this issue, we found ourselves really challenged by our colleagues who sometimes didn't think that this was as important an audience for us to serve. The good news here is that there were a lot more people on our side than there were on the other side, and so we were able to sort of plow through. But I think that there is still a lot of work to be done in this space. And in government, it's very progressive, but I would say we still, certainly in local government here in New York City, but on the state level, we still have lots and lots of challenges, lots of challenges. The City of New York actually has a confidentiality policy, which every single New York City employee learns about when they are hired. And it is a confidentiality policy that that Mayor Bloomberg signed in 2003 that really focuses on a number of protected classes of information that we might ask an individual when they come to us for a service. And immigration status is included. New York City employees are all aware that when you take that information, we maintain it confidential. So when you're enrolling a family for schools, for our school system, you shouldn't ask them whether they're documented or undocumented, quite honestly. But if in the event that someone does, that information is maintained confidential. It becomes most evident and most important around public benefits, such as social service benefits, or healthcare, or housing, where the distinction, quite honestly, is around funding sources. So on the federal side, when money is essentially given to us by the federal government and sort of makes its way into community programs and community services, we've got to differentiate who those dollars are representing. And in some instances, it's quite clear that it goes to legal permanent residents. But in other instances, it's not. In the City of New York, and to its credit, the State of New York actually supplements a good amount of money to ensure that we aren't demonstrating this distinction. And in a place where you see that very evidently is around healthcare. Mm-hmm. So I'll get into that. Why do we in the City of New York care so much about serving the population? For lots of reasons. One, I would say that this actually, the good news here is that this is not, Bloomberg is very strong on this, but this is something that precedes us as an administration. Giuliani, who most understand to be not as, forgive me, kind a mayor in the City of New York, was actually not bad on this issue. He was very strong on this issue. During his time as mayor in the city, we actually sued the federal government because they were asking us to disclose people's status, and Giuliani said we weren't going to do that. And so, to his credit. And prior to that, both Dinkins and Koch, all very clear that this is a city where documentation status isn't a distinction. We want to ensure that children are enrolled in our schools. We want to ensure that families are cared for. And part of this actually is a public safety narrative. Part of it is the right thing to do, but part of it for New York is actually around a public safety narrative. Around public health in particular, we want all children to be immunized, so we need to make sure that you have access to healthcare, because one child in a classroom without immunization or without ability to access a primary care physician could fundamentally mean that that child is now passing around something to the rest of the class. So there's a public safety nuance there. Also, people, when they're more comfortable, they tend to live their lives more successfully. And New York's narrative is really about, I think we like to say, when you invest in your communities, they invest in you. And so the return on investment of our ability to provide services to every New Yorker, irrespective of status, fundamentally means we know that they will thrive here better. That is a simple fact for us, which is a good thing. unique to New York, though, is in fact that we have a lot more power in our city. The state has lots of power in New York. The governor certainly does. His politics are very progressive, so we're lucky. The state legislature, a good number of them come from New York. So they're not, it's not a uniform voice, unlike our city council here, but they are not influenced, they can't be. Our delegation is pretty powerful on the state level. So even though there might be some policies that are discussed on the state level that might be unfriendly to immigrants, undocumented immigrants statewide, it sort of dies on the vine up there in Albany. And we're very lucky with that reality. It's very different than what has happened in Arizona or in Alabama, for example, or in a state like North Carolina, where these state legislatures are in fact recreating policies that are so detrimental to immigrants, in particular undocumented immigrants in the state, that places like Charlotte or places like Birmingham are suffering, or Phoenix are really suffering and battling out how do they provide appropriate services to an audience they find as important to them, for a lot of the reasons, public safety, the right thing to do. Localities are burdened with this responsibility because we are the ones who serve people. We are the ones who directly serve people in every way. So there's a difference. A lot of folks recognize this as blue cities and red states. And New York isn't that, right? We are a blue city and a blue state. This is the sort of distinction around the sort of partisan lines. But it is a phenomena that exists, that is unique to us, that I think mirrors a bit about the some of the European reality. In New York, I want to just mention a couple of things. And so the child welfare narrative is an important one. We in the city of New York, when it comes to children in particular, and I actually think it's a federal, I think it's something that we demonstrate as, forgive me if this sounds Pollyanna-ish, but you know, I think it's an American thing. I think we care about children, and I think we provide services to ensure children and their well-being. In the city, or in the state of New York, we have this opportunity when a woman is pregnant to provide prenatal care assistance free, irrespective of status. When a woman is pregnant and presents at a hospital, no hospital can turn her away because the federal government, through the state, will pay for that child, for that woman to receive prenatal care and postnatal care. In the state of New York, we sign up for that as a state, so this is very important for us. It's actually an opportunity that states across the country can take. Not all take it, but we in New York do. And the reality for children, in fact, is that when they're born, they then get access to eligible, they get access to health care, which will be changing under the exchange, but still is relevant and available, traditionally known as Child Health Plus. But in essence, continuing this opportunity that a child can always have access to health care. And that's actually pretty important. When we have kids who are removed from their homes and then end up in our foster care system, those kids are provided every single benefit, irrespective of status, as any other child. I would say that when we have children who actually are U.S. born, whose parents are undocumented and need public health assistance, public assistance, food stamps, food vouchers, housing, our system provides benefits to that child, but it includes that family, and we're not penalizing the family. We're not saying you can't get any benefits because your parent is undocumented. It's actually not what we do at all. So many families exist and can in some instances survive, and I'm not saying well, but they do get benefits that allows the family to get access. So it could, in fact, help supplement some rent. It could, in fact, help supplement some weekly food substances or subsidies. So it's a pretty big deal. The other thing I want to just mention is the police. Police and community for us in New York is a big deal. And it is actually across the country. And I would say a lot has been written about this. Europe struggles a lot with this discussion. For us, it's pretty clear. And this is actually the Giuliani narrative that carries over, which is in order for you to create an environment and communities that feel comfortable coming forward in the event of a crime, they need to feel comfortable, and you need to protect them. Right? And this is quite real. There's lots of debate about this these days with our police department, but But in fact, in a city like New York, we have a very robust police department that really mirrors the diversity of New York City's residents. We've got an immigrant outreach unit that is embedded in the community affairs division of the police department. And their sole job is to go out into new immigrant communities and create these relationships to ensure that people aren't afraid and that we're responding to some of the challenges that we see. So a lot of these strategies are quite unique to us, but they're not things that other cities can't borrow or learn from. And not that they're all perfect, but they have, in fact, provided a great opportunity for us locally to be able to respond to challenges on the ground fairly quickly. So,
great. So I have a few questions because I could spend all day with these fabulous ladies. But I know that you probably have some questions as well. So maybe I'll start it off and then open it up to the audience and we can just have a conversation. So one of the things I find really fascinating right now in the U.S. is that the economic arguments that are driving the narrative to reform the immigration system and the contributions that immigrants make from an economic perspective has been very powerful. So I'm curious about are there any narratives? You talked about the narratives and the frames that are so important, Sarah, and getting folks to shift their thinking around migration and migrants and undocumented migrants. So I'm curious about whether you've been able to see any economic arguments to be able to support leadership at the local level.
You mean economic argument for inclusion?
Exactly, exactly. Taxes, helping local economies.
We're so far from that. I mean, the idea that you might argue that, I saw recently argument that you should have a driving license here so that you can go to work. The UK government's just proposed making sure that it's absolutely impossible to get a driving license. And the idea that we might use the argument then they won't be able to go to work is unthinkable, because they were taught that as, well, they shouldn't be working, they're taking other people's jobs. So there is no narrative other than recognition from NGOs that irregular migrants are doing jobs that perhaps other people don't want to do. The governments would be united in thinking that the priority must be to keep people out of work, because that will be the greatest incentive to leave the country. So the way in which the economic argument is playing is making it more difficult to provide services. Municipal government is stretched financially, losing funds. Funds are being taken away from the welfare services. So those grey areas where it was possible to provide access are narrowing down. The discretion is going. So in Greece, for instance, doctors who choose to go beyond what they're allowed to do to provide a service might still choose to do that, but they can no longer get the medicines that they once could prescribe because that leeway in the system is becoming much narrower. The only upside, if you like, is that the harsher conditions that people are experiencing is raising awareness amongst people who perhaps on the more progressive side about this particular issue, who weren't concerned about it before. So although greater hostility from one side, greater awareness and willingness to contribute on the other.
That's actually really helpful.
Can I tack on to your question?
Sure, please, go ahead.
So,
can you introduce yourself?
I did.
Oh, just one more time, just so we can start the conversation.
Suzette Masters from the J.M. Kaplan Fund. So just to tack on to Archana's point, I think we in the United States were not far from where Europe is today 5 years ago. And I think there's been a concerted effort to build the economic case. It had been a rights-based case. It wasn't going anywhere. And I think there's been a concerted effort to repackage the debate, to blur the distinction between immigrants who are here legally and those who aren't, and just blanketly say, this is what immigrants have done for the United States, this is what they can do for localities. And someone that Fatima works very closely with, Jeremy Robbins at the Partnership for a New American Economy, has been brilliant in packaging a whole bunch of studies to really recast the benefits of immigration. And so, for example, it doesn't matter whether you're documented or undocumented, if you're an entrepreneur, you know, you're a net gain, right? Or if you're occupying housing that was abandoned and renting properties that were abandoned, right? That's a net positive for the economy, the local economy. So I think there's been a whole rebranding effort that's really gained steam and is working now. But they will both tell you, Archana and Fatima, 5 years ago, we were exactly where Europe is, maybe even behind where Europe is. No driver's licenses, you know, the, what was the name of that awful act? Real ID. You know, there were just awful things happening and lots of demonization. But I think what's interesting is that I think there's a playbook here that can be adapted, yes, you know, for other cities.
How did they win the argument that while legal migrants contribute to the economy, even people
accept that, they still pay taxes?
Yes, but if they weren't there, wouldn't other people have those jobs? How do they overcome argument?
So interestingly enough, one of the reports actually that was done was the, and it might have been a collaborative, but that it was a stark reality for me, was a report on the agricultural industry and the reality of what undocumented labor means for the agricultural industry and our inability to actually fundamentally do more to ensure that we have more people working means we actually throw away annually $73 million of unpicked fruits and vegetables. And so the truth is that with the labor that's doing the jobs no one else wants to do, we still aren't, in fact, even responding to all of the job opportunities that can exist. Because if people wanted those jobs, we'd actually be able to pick.
And the other thing that went with that campaign was businesses, right, speaking up at the same time and being a counterpoint to the anti-immigrant folks and saying, hey, we want to hire these people. We can't under our current system. You haven't created other ways for people to come in. So we are in between a rock and a hard place, you know, and we need these people and they contribute. And so I think there was a whole bunch of different pieces coming together that hadn't been there before that are now helping to get us where we are.
But I want to pick up on something that you said, which is which we've all, I think, witnessed and pushing forward, which is framing. Right, I think the sort of point that you made around a framing reality is really quite critical. I was at a talk that was done where a fairly the former Secretary of Commerce during the Bush administration, whose name escapes me, but who's been sort of the Republican lead on comprehensive immigration reform, said we can't do this without the reality of immigrants in all of their capacity, right? It is the restaurant worker and the chef. It is the hospital, the maintenance worker and the doctor. It is the, student and the professor. Like, that is the landscape that these audiences all take up. And we as a nation have to recognize everybody in their full capacity. And I just think it is a framing reality. We're talking about it differently.
And that means that you've got greater transparency about who these people are, what kind of jobs they're doing, so that that case can be made, so that evidence needs to be there.
The other thing that I think is interesting is, just so on the case of what they're doing, is someone I heard speak, is a colleague of ours, a man named Jason Marzak, doesn't call low-wage immigrant workers low-wage immigrant workers. He actually termed the audience as essential hands. And I think every time he speaks and he says, these are essential hands, these are essential hands, these are, you start to hear people respond to that very differently.
It's a framing piece. I have a million questions, but I know I saw a question from you in the corner. And can you say your name?
Helen Epstein. I have, I guess, two questions for Commissioner Fatima. One of them is... you said that undocumented women, if they're pregnant, are guaranteed free prenatal and antenatal care, but who pays for delivery, especially if it's complicated and cesareans and all that sort of stuff? Is that also...
So it's all included. You get basically something called prenatal care assistance. You get access to the prenatal care assistance plan.
Okay.
Acronym is PCAP. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the other question is, can you tell us a little, as I know this is sort of awkward, about the sort of ramifications, if there's any discussion about, you know, the Baby Hope case, for those who don't know. There was a little girl about 20 years ago who was found inside a picnic cooler. And it seems as though, according to the Times yesterday, that a lot of her she was from an undocumented migrant family from some Mexico, I think, and one of the reasons why her relatives, including her parents, didn't come forward sooner is because they were afraid it would jeopardize their immigration situation, that they would be deported. And so,
I just don't know the case, but if somebody here does, you should feel comfortable talking about it. I'd have to do some good reading and then we can talk.
But I think it's probably early days, but I would imagine the police and your office would.
But it is something that you picked up about, Helen, about the relationship between local law enforcement and communities that they are in service towards, and what's that relationship look like in an ever-changing conversation around migrants, undocumented migrants, and what have you. And so I'm curious about the role that law enforcement has played in your research, and whether they've been effective advocates for more rights of undocumented migrants, or have they been quieter? Because, and I'd love for you to share a little bit more about your experience in working with law enforcement and in the context of immigration reform in this country.
I've struggled to find examples where the police are effectively allowing safe reporting so that they can hear from undocumented migrants without threat of deportation. There's a great example in Spain where there's actually a national ordinance which says that if an undocumented woman is the victim of domestic violence, she can report that without fear that she will be deported. That they tried to do that through an unwritten understanding, and that didn't work. People didn't feel able to come forward.
Mm-hmm.
And the national ministry responsible for equality had a major drive on domestic violence. The evidence from research and NGOs and so on showed that there was a significant problem amongst this section of the community. So the ministry decided they weren't going to be able to achieve their targets and what they wanted to do unless they were able to reach this group of people. So they passed this ordinance, which provides the sort of protection that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There's an example in one of the Dutch police forces where they have not a written rule, but what they call a gentleman's agreement, which is known throughout the city, that people can come forward to report that they're the victim or witness to a crime and they won't be deported. But because it's not written down, they cannot absolutely be sure that that won't happen. There might still be officers who are gung-ho. There's nowhere where that kind of thing is written down. Many places, I was told, well, the police probably use their discretion in the way one might want them to, but it's not established enough for the undocumented migrants to feel confident in coming mm-hmm. forward. So they must be very vulnerable to all sorts of offences, and it means the police, of course, are not getting the information that they need.
You may have heard me visibly, or see me visibly sigh, because despite the fact that how scary and terrifying that is, there's a lot of connections between what you just described and what's happening in the U.S. But I'd love to hear a little bit more if you have any experience in working with local law enforcement around the relationship and the role that they play in protecting all New Yorkers, and the role that and migrants and undocumented.
Yeah. So well. I think the sort of domestic violence example is a really rich one. The country has a policy that was recently debated and thankfully fell in our favor about violence against women. And in particular, victims of domestic violence who are undocumented, who feel comfortable coming forward and essentially testifying that they're whomever. And it's actually not just women, it's anyone who's a victim of violence, testifying that they are the victim, can actually have a change of status, right? Can actually get access to a different visa that allows them to essentially get on a pathway to legalization. And
this is practice, or this is what people were arguing
this is
for?
Well, it's actually law. Mm-hmm. It's law in the country, and we actually, it was up again for debate, and it actually fell, it was a little testy, it was touch and go a little for many of us, for the nation, but the folks in D.C. got it together, unlike what's happening now. So the Violence Against Women Act, you know, remains law. But in the city of New York, it's actually a very big reality for us, because the city of New York has created family justice centers. Essentially, they are co-located centers that serve victims of domestic violence. They are co-located with our district attorney's offices. I mean, we literally... someone who is a victim can come forward, our police department collaborates, and we are able to really effectively get help for victims fairly quickly, actually. I think that we do a really serious job about ensuring if anyone is the victim or witness to a crime, that they are protected. We say it a lot. Someone is in fact arrested and is undocumented, the federal government has instituted a nationwide system called Secure Communities, where they're now essentially taking from every single law enforcement agency fingerprints. And New York, as much as we've tried to push back, we are an activated city, and so anyone who is arrested, their fingerprints does in fact get sent to the federal government, and it can in fact trigger someone's the Department of Homeland Security to instigate a deportation request. We in the city have used some thoughtful policymaking around how we protect New Yorkers, certainly if they're not convicted, certainly if they fall within any number of categories. So we've pushed back, actually, on the federal government on this, which is something New York and Chicago have actually done, mm-hmm. and other municipalities are working on.
One of the things that Sarah and I were able to do before coming into this luncheon was have a little chat about the public face of undocumented immigrants around the world. And one of what I posed was one of the reasons why we're having a conversation about immigration reform in 2013 and hopefully 2014 is the fact that those that were most impacted have a louder voice and a larger platform to be able to demand and advocate for their own selves. Because in the 80s and the 90s, oftentimes immigration advocates were, I'll just say it, like usually straight white male, and they were tasked and heralded as being the spokespeople for undocumented immigrants in this country. What I find really fascinating is that over the last 20 years, there's been a remarkable shift for undocumented immigrants to tell their own stories. And I'm thinking specifically of the Dreamers, undocumented young people in this country, and now the Dreamer Moms. And there's a new group called Dreamer Moms that got started in Florida. And so it's just been incredibly powerful for young people to be able to tell their stories. And in that, thread a very, very sophisticated gender analysis around this work as well, and being able to connect and bring in, for example, domestic workers. And so be able to unite domestic workers and young people and children. And so I find that is fairly new. I would say that's probably in the last 4 or 5 years that the Dreamers and undocumented immigrants to be able to tell their own stories has been very effective. So I'm curious about what you're seeing in Europe, and if there is not that ground, what's possible, and is it possible in 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
I can see the power of that happening, mm-hmm. and what a difference that must have made to the debate, yes. put a human face, that these are real people and not a threat, mm-hmm. in the way that it can be demonized in the public imagination. The question is how you got there. It's very rare for us to even have someone on a conference platform. The umbrella body of NGOs in Europe called PICUM, based in Brussels, that puts on conferences, they always try to have one person there who is actually undocumented, who can tell his or her story to bring it home to us, what we're spending the day discussing. But that's rare. It's very rare to see anyone speak publicly because they're laying themselves open to arrest. And there is as yet no movement to do that. A little bit more, I think, in France, one or two other countries, and certainly in my own, but still very rare. So there's no movement there, there's no visibility, and that no doubt contributes to the public sense that these are a different kind of people who pose a threat, and you know, that one wouldn't want them to stay. So for me, the big question is, how do we get from where we are to a position where enough people feel comfortable enough to become public and tell their own story so that the not-for-profits don't have to tell it for them?
I mean, to be clear, it was unthinkable that undocumented immigrants would have a voice and a platform and to mm-hmm. come out and be undocumented and unafraid, even, would you say, 3 years ago? 5 years
yeah,
ago?
I mean, I think many of us remember when it started, the sort of organizing. I have to tell you that there's, maybe it was 3 or 4 years ago when it's the dreamer youth that I think really came forward and really started to say, we're unafraid. We're unapologetic, and we're, you know, we're undocumented, we're unafraid, and we're unapologetic. And I really feel like it did put a human face, but it also, in addition to putting a human face, it was a bunch of, you know, it was a group of young people who can tell that they arrived at a certain age mm-hmm. and that they had grown up here and that they'd known nothing but, you know, this as their home, and they deserve that. And I will just add that during the Democratic National Convention, a young student who was a student of Jill Biden's, mm-hmm. At her community college, introduced her and came out on stage and said, I was undocumented. I mean, this is on a national platform. This young woman was articulating her support, you know, and was the recipient of deferred action. But this is now a very different landscape. That would not have happened, I think, mm-hmm. in the previous campaign. But it, I mean, the tone is really at a time where people are really, I think, coming out is a fair way to say it, you know?
But I do think that there's been a little bit of deification of some categories of undocumented immigrants and demonization of others. So I think the dreamers are riding a wave right now. You know, the valedictorian who all but four status would be going to Caltech, you know, like, I think there is some of that, you know, overlay. And then I think that people that have been in the past viewed more positively are now being demonized. So, for example, refugees of Muslim backgrounds, despite their legal status, are being demonized at the local level. And, you know, so I think it's more complicated.
If I just point about, I mean, I recognize that in that the one set of people who, for us, are visible are the people who have been targeted for deportation. So, for whom in the way the game is up. So mm-hmm. they're then public. And sometimes there is then a public campaign to stop them being deported, perhaps because the kids are in the local school and the mum is known to the other mums, kind of thing. And public opinion is fickle in that sense, that, you know, there might be a majority of public opinion in favour of a policy that deports people, but once it's somebody you know, mm-hmm. You take a different view. And there the campaign can, what word you used, the opposite of demonise, but anyway, you know, sort of sanctify, this is a good person, they contribute to the community, they shouldn't be deported. And the sense is there are sort of good irregular migrants who we want to stay and maybe others who we don't. So I recognise the distinction you're making. I suppose the strength of starting somewhere is that there's a chink that opens the door. So. With children, for instance, putting a lot of effort on changing policies for children is a start from which then we might grow, for instance. I don't say we, I'm not the advocate, but the not-for-profit advocates would take it from there.
Thank you. Oh, we have two questions. Maybe we can stack them. Okay. So we'll get both. Your first and then we'll...
I had a question about specifically New York. I know that there's a movement now to extend municipal voting rights to undocumented migrants in the city, and I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that, both the arguments for, which are fairly self-evident, and those against. I know it's likely to pass, and I think they already voted on it recently, right? Last week or something? Or an initial resolution? I don't know the specifics.
I'll speak to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to ask
I have a question for you and a question for you as well. My question is about extending health care benefits to undocumented migrants. Does that include mental health care as well as accommodations for disabilities? It does.
Yes. Yes.
That's huge.
If anyone... So I'll just answer that.
Good. Please do.
First... I'll get to the healthcare question.
Okay, so ask
her question, okay, and then I'll.
My question has to do with how much of the undocumented movement or whatever in Europe recognizes the Roma population and the experiences they have with being ejected from certain countries in the name of irregular migration.
So on the health, and then I'll answer the municipal voter rights question. So on the health question, New York City has a really robust public hospital system, known as the Health and Hospitals Corporations. And so you've passed these places, Bellevue Hospital, Metropolitan, here in the city, Gouverneur. I can list everyone for you if you're interested. But you know, anyway, it's a very robust system. And it really is, in fact, where we turn no one away. And so there is a law on the books that no hospital can turn ever a patient away. That sadly is not what we have witnessed before. With that said, we know in the city of New York that we have a public hospital system who will ensure the care of anyone who walks through its doors. I will say that for children with mental health issues, a big issue, there are services abound, and they are included in either the child health insurance portfolio benefits, as well as if you walk through the doors. And we've seen some challenges with individuals who come through, and we know that there's care there. The other area is around disability. So this is another reality around the American nuance, which is individuals with disabilities get benefits uniquely, and there's something called emergency Medicaid that an hospital can activate or can apply for. And one of the this is very weedy. One of the justifications could, in fact, be anyone's disability. But so the federal government will allow certain benefits, and disability is one of them. Demonstration of proving it. On the voter rights issue, so this is where I'm going to sound like a gross bureaucrat, so I'm sorry, which is we in the city of New York have not endorsed municipal voting rights. This is a conversation and a debate that's happening within our city council. This is where I will sound further bureaucratic, which is, of course, they would want to ensure that there are voting opportunities because it provides for more people on the local level to participate. Once upon a time in the city of New York, when people would do, when there were elections around school boards, anyone could participate. We now have something called community education councils. Again, anyone can participate in those opportunities. And furthermore, sounding like a bureaucrat, we in the administration do not comment on resolutions, but it is a resolution that has passed. A resolution is a recommendation in the law. I think that we're going to see a greater debate about this in the next mayoral administration.
So it's very nascent.
It's very. But it's been a conversation that has been underway for quite some time, and we've got a policy brief on it, if you're interested. But
can you say why the mayor's office doesn't endorse the move to extend voting rights?
Oh, God. Why does... It's not something... I mean, I think it's been our administration... I think every mayor, quite honestly, not just Bloomberg, has not been in favor of for undocumented... immigrants participating in local municipal voting. There's a question around legal permanent residence, right? Because you have to be a citizen to participate.
Yeah.
There's, I think, been some debate, but I think that the argument we have heard in this last conversation was one of the benefits of being an American is to participate in this political process, and we must maintain it. You know, sort of keep the sanctity of that.
I can't say that I endorse it per se,
but it's just...
Because it raises the whole question of where the line should be drawn. And it seems to... You know, in human rights debate, we have this concept of proportionality. Is it proportional to... first of all, you know, is there a legitimate reason to deny access? And then... is it proportional to actually do it? And one might say, well, it's disproportional to deny access to education for a child, but it's perfectly proportional to deny the right to vote because the consequences are different. And that's, I'm just interested that that's one of the places that you draw the line, that there isn't as strong a case for extending voting rights as there is for allowing kids to go to schools.
Well, I think a really interesting justification in terms of what's proportional and where do you justify policies, and I'm not putting out my personal opinion either, but
One of the technical, something that's interesting technically is that if you do vote as a green card holder in a local election, let's say theoretically, and somehow that leads to a confusion for you in that that leads you to vote in a federal election, you actually run into trouble down the road with in adjusting status in that it's it's illegal to vote, right? Exactly, which jeopardizes your status. So, as a city, don't we have an interest in protecting the ability of our residents to become citizens in the future? So,
and
I think
not
that's a
concern to participate
right,
yeah. in any
because of that risk.
Interesting. Okay. There's a question in the back.
Oh, but wait, I don't think she answered.
Oh, and there's another question
about the Roma.
That's right,
that's
about the Roma.
Right.
The very, very fascinating
right.
question.
Roma is an interesting one in that there is obviously a huge focus in Europe at the moment on trying to address the situation there, and not least through Open Society's many efforts there. But most of the Roma in Europe are European Union citizens. Now, because of the extension of the borders of the European Union, the people who are from Eastern European countries are now EU citizens with the full rights of EU citizens, so they're in no way undocumented. Absolutely. But that makes it, in a sense, a different set of issues and a different set of campaigning organisations that are dealing with it. So the
but
NGO...
When they're evicted from France for being from Romania, when they're evicted
yes.
from Italy for just not being Italian, I mean, that's
major
similar
issues
issue.
Taken up for not-for-profits, tested through litigation, so on. It's just, it wouldn't be helpful for them to be deemed undocumented. They're not. They are EU citizens. So it's addressed by the organisations that deal with EU citizens and seek to protect the rights of EU citizens, who indeed are not even supposed to be called migrants because we're merely exercising our mobility rights within the borders of the European Union. And there's a whole debate there about the fact that people have face the same barriers as any other migrant. But actually, you can't be called a migrant and you can't access the same funds in Europe that are open to people from outside of Europe. But so, big issues, yes, being addressed in a major way, but not within the framework of undocumented migrant racial for the reason I'm here.
Thank you. And now to the back of the room.
And if you could speak up, that'd be great, just because.
Sure, so I just wanted to clarify two things and then I have a question for Dr. Spencer. Regarding the citizen voting rights, just to be clear, to the best of my knowledge, the New York City Coalition to Expand Voting Rights is really only pushing for legal residents to have voting rights
okay.
in local elections. So I don't think there's a mainstream push for undocumented immigrants at this point. And the issue with non-citizens voting in federal elections, I don't think that would be a big deal here in New York because our state and local elections are held on different years than the federal elections. So it seems like a very simple public education campaign would be able to address that potentially large issue. And then my question for you, Dr. Spencer, is are you familiar with whether this is gaining traction in Europe? I know there's cities or municipalities in Germany that have resident voting rights, and I wanted to ask whether you've come across this in your research elsewhere.
I haven't been working on that at all. Really interesting issue, but it hasn't come up in the course of this, of course. At all, and I'm not au fait with how far it's progressing in the European level. There are debates, but how far it's gone, I'm not sure.
Thank you.
And well, maybe we'll stack the next two questions. So Lee, and then...
Okay. So I guess I have a question about maybe to try to discuss a little more about the historical and social framing of the issue, because I think there's a huge impact where we talk about immigration, how it's a different context than it's than European migration, or and how we treat individuals as such, and even within local cities, and you know the legacy of New York as opposed to like St. Louis is very different. So, I mean, I just wonder also if you both of you can talk more about the historical and the social context, and how much that needs to be reframed or change within a different, you know, in sort of the reframing of narrative, and really to what degree can we initiate change in public opinion to sort of align that, or is it a matter of, you know,
a situation context where there are opportunities that present themselves with demographic shifts, and so that, you know, there's an imperative to, you know, change the conversation.
That's actually sort of connected to my question in a way, which is that in the U.S., obviously, the immigration debate has been heavily burdened with racism and xenophobia. And clearly those are also issues in Europe, to a greater or lesser extent, depending on the country. So I'm wondering, to what extent do you perceive that racism and xenophobia and other kinds of discrimination are impacting the way that services are provided in cities to migrants versus just the legal, technical impediments that exist?
Two really good questions. The idea of having to reframe the whole narrative and not just the issue, I think you're absolutely spot on. I was very taken when I was here before talking to Fatima and one or two other city people about your narrative, the city built on the hard-working immigrant, and also that many of those people started off as undocumented, and look where they've built this great city, and we just don't have that narrative at all. But I understand in the South there's a competing narrative of the immigrant as being a welfare scrounger. Now that's where we are, particularly the undocumented. I mean, they're either taking people's jobs or they're on benefits or both. And we don't have this sense of Europe as having been built through the hard work of immigrants, although if you look at trends and numbers and so on, I'm sure that the experience is so different. So, yes, we need to change the narrative, not just frame the issue. And how we do that is a very difficult question. I think there are places... If I think of the places where the issue is most openly discussed and it's most openly acknowledged that undocumented migrants are there and that they're part of the city, so a place like Barcelona or Genoa in Italy or Amsterdam, where there is much greater recognition now than there was even 5 years ago that these are cities that have been built on the back of immigration, that at least a third or more of the population, even now, are sort of foreign-born, the narrative there is changing, and many of these cities are branding themselves as having a diverse, inclusive image as part of the public selling of the city. London is very much the same. Now, I suppose it's still a step from there to say not just any immigrants, but actually, let's face it, this is included undocumented as well. We're definitely not there yet, but perhaps we've taken a step in that direction. There are certainly many more cities now that are comfortable with an inclusive narrative and are overtly trying to help their residents feel part of the city, even if they can't necessarily always feel part of the country where the politics is less conducive. Racism is just hugely significant in anti-immigrant feeling, no way around that. What I've been surprised to find is that in those cities and in the debates at the national level on including undocumented migrants, it hasn't figured strongly. For instance, the fact that the people that we're talking about were from, say, an African background as opposed to an East European background doesn't seem to have figured in the debate. So it certainly does overall in terms of the hostility to migrants. So I have to say, in my own country, people are pretty well as hostile to East Europeans as they are to people from anywhere else. So it's very complicated. It's as though we have sort of racial discourse about people regardless of colour if they come from abroad. It's a more xenophobic debate. But how it's wound up in whether some cities respond positively and others don't is a very complicated question, which is difficult to answer.
So I think that this is an interesting space, because the truth is that the American narrative is fundamentally that we were peopled, and the reality of a story of a place like New York as a continuous gateway, quite different than a St. Louis that is a new gateway city, or some parts of the South, or, you know, different, you know, places that just, you know, the coastal cities have always seen immigration. And generally speaking, any number of us randomly can articulate some story, right? I think, you know, it's important, and we sort of heart, you know, the president has done this, we locally have done this, but we saw the sort of anti-immigrant sentiment, you know, rearing its head in Arizona. It made its way to New York, where we had a number of attacks on immigrants. Here, we had to sort of, we in the city of New York had to do what we can to make people remember, you know, the immigrants of yesterday were becoming the discriminators of today, and we sort of had to sort of have a celebration of our stories, and, you know, resulted actually in a full public service campaign with me on on doing 16 commercials. But all that to say that people here took it seriously. So you're right, it is a distinction. I will say that the new gateway cities really struggle with this conversation of race, and this, I will say, is a struggle we still have in New York. I think we're better about it, largely because we really are a city of colors, and it is a celebration that we all really recognize and own, and in fact, it's largely a big reason why people are here. And, you know, what would be considered, you know, an African-American or our Black communities, you know, three generations ago were Caribbean and were, you know, could track their... could trace their roots to some part of, you know, the Caribbean. So it's a little different. I will tell you, recently being in the South and having this debate where we were having a conversation about, you know, the fact is, you know, is America Black or white, or is it multiracial? This is not a conversation America is ready to have. It's different, I think, in Europe, though I think Suzette said it best. I think what you're seeing now is a new demonization of a new group, right? So once upon a time, there was real anger towards Latinos, specifically Mexicans, in this very derogatory, divisive, disgusting language. You now hear people use that towards Muslims. And refugees who've been resettled in certain places. In Europe, forget it, all bets are off. People say whatever they want about anybody, and if they're Muslim, even more so, right? Like, it's really crazy, actually. But in the US, I think we're seeing this real debate. The other thing, there's a lot of literature written on this, on this black-white narrative, or this multiracial narrative, and the fact that Latinos come in, or immigrants come in largely, and they're recognized and treated, quote unquote, as African Americans are, or once were. But as they move in their economic and social path, they tend to achieve points of success that then invites them to be part of the white audience, and therefore it becomes a now demonizing, or becomes a distinction between Black and immigrant, right? And for many of us who've been in communities and have seen this, this is a real challenge and one that we struggle to unpack. But I have to admit that I am a very comfortable, outspoken American woman, and in Europe, and I'm Muslim, and in Europe I am uncomfortable, right? And it is very clear that people have a real reaction to me and to my ethnic roots and what I identify as. It's very alarming, sorry. But for me, I feel very uncomfortable.
I'm actually, so it's 1:47, and I actually have a question that may take us to the end of the conversation. So as part of your fellowship at the Open Society Foundations, I know that you are looking into the U.S. experience for insights, despite the fact that we've got this very contentious political issue that we're navigating ourselves. And so I do think it's fascinating that we tend to sweep the things that are not so great that's happening right now. And you had mentioned the stuff that's happening in Arizona and the work that's happening in Alabama, so it's been really challenging. So I'm very curious about what insights you are taking with you after having spent the last few moons kind of speaking and talking and learning and sharing with other advocates.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's another good question. The reality is I spent 95% of the time looking at the issues in Europe. There are 28 member states, mm-hmm. and they have hugely different migration histories, welfare states, everything. So actually just trying to unravel why they're doing things the way they are there has been exceedingly complicated. So I quickly recognized that there was no way I could do anything sort of comparative with the US other than just look for insights when I've had the opportunity to be here. I suppose what I've found, with notwithstanding the huge variation here and recognition that in your new gateways in the south and so on, there's some very alarming practice, but looking at New York and the other cities which have been, let's say, progressive in pushing the boat out to provide services and enable safe reporting and so on, I think what I have found valuable about it is just seeing how the issues are framed, because we can learn from that the arguments that are used here that have been successful in shifting the terms of the debate, and then considering whether it can be successful. The arguments are transferable, the politics and the history and some of the narrative clearly isn't. So that's what disentangling. And I think there are definitely lessons that we can learn about how we frame it in economic terms or pragmatic terms, and not always in human rights terms and so on. Just giving the example, for instance, I think it was someone from New Haven telling me that what really shifted the debate there was recognition that undocumented migrants were walking ATMs because they couldn't have a bank account. Everybody knew that on payday they were carrying money on them and they were consistently the victims of muggings, and the police were frustrated they couldn't do something about that. Well, I recognise that issue, and other people recognise that issue, and the fact that New Haven dealt with it in the way that it did, talked to the banks, got them to agree that they should open the bank again, just a sort of pragmatic response, so sensible, it gives us the idea, maybe we could actually get something like that going as well. So it's those kind of transferable ideas and the transferable rationales for it that are exciting. It'll take a lot longer for us to actually shift the whole narrative, but I'm not sure that our experience, certainly in many cities, is so very different from New York, for instance, in terms of the extent to which its history is wound up with immigration and indeed undocumented migration. So I think there are lessons to take there too.
You know, the thing I failed to include in the response to the peopling is actually, so both when we were in Turin and a previous trip that I had had in with Florence, there was this vernacular of like, no, you know, we cannot have these migrants here. And I remember a colleague of ours, Muzaffer Chisti, turning to the audience and saying, you know, you sent 20 million of your people to my country. And the Italian audience was like, what? And he said, you... And so we actually sort of... He and I picked up on this. We were on this panel together. And the truth was that the folks in the room had forgotten that they were, in fact, sending nations to us. And that when their people came to the U.S., they were mistreated. And what they were doing was essentially reenacting that with new audiences. I mean, you know, Europe peopled for a good chunk of time with a number of undocumented individuals, though that's not what it was called then. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think so there's a space, I wonder, in the framing a narrative, how do people understand that they, in fact, were responsible for the peopling of Latin America? I mean, you know, the reality of Argentina or Brazil and the sort of roots that they can connect back to Italy and the rest of, you know, and Germany and to the region as a whole it's where, you know.
Yeah. Can I add something? There's a film called La America, which looks at this exact issue. It looks as, I'm not going to get into the plot, but it sort of mirrors the experience of Albanian immigrants coming into Italy and Italian immigrants going into the U.S. And it's a really beautiful story. And it just picks up exact, it's La America without an apostrophe.
Okay.
And it's just this exact same situation that you were saying. And Italians tend to forget that. Lived in Italy for 3 years, and there's this reactionary sort of rejection of anything that's foreign, but they don't remember that they were coming to the U.S.
And their wealth and their success is largely due to the success of their estrangeiri coming to you know to the U.S. and Latin America and being able to go back home and help families, and that sort of this idea of remittances was real then as it is now. So we're just different colors.
And with that, this has been the best 90 minutes of my day. Thank you so much, Chair Spencer and Papa Mishama.